This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Big news! One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please, give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Hey, stop me if you've heard this one before. There was inflation news today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today. This one is the 12th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, sometimes you wake up eager to cover the economic news of the day and you realize that the economic news of the day doesn't really feel like news. The Consumer Price Index that came out this morning, data for September, put year-over-year inflation at 3.7%. In August, year-over-year, 3.7%. Earlier this week, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York was out with its survey of consumer expectations, which showed our expectations for inflation. They are stable, too. So if the news is that there's no news, is that good news? Here's Marketplace's Kristen Schwab.
So to answer the question, yes, there's a reason why the phrase no news is good news exists.
I'll take it.
Of course, it would be better if we were getting news that inflation were falling.
But we're still progressing.
Those are economists Mark Zandi, Carola Binder, and Sean Snaith. Zandi at Moody's Analytics says inflation has more or less been stagnant for most of 2023, but that this is part of the journey, and we just need to sit tight and be patient.
People think the pandemic is in the rearview mirror, and it is, but the fallout still continues.
We're still waiting for the dust to completely settle when it comes to consumer spending and work habits. And we're waiting for all the action from the Federal Reserve to settle, too. Carola Binder is at Haverford College.
It's kind of a popular expression about monetary policy that it has long and variable lag.
Long and variable lag. That's economist speak for boosting interest rates is a bit of an experiment that will take a while to get the results.
So that's partly why things are so uncertain right now. We're kind of waiting and seeing what is it going to do to inflation and what is it going to do to the labor market.
The worry, though, is that as the path to the Fed's inflation target of 2% stretches, consumers will get used to prices going up. It's why Sean Snaith at the University of Central Florida says stubborn inflation can hurt the progress the Fed has already made.
You've got to get the job done because the expectations are really a powerful thing. And, you know, if this path to 2, you know, stretches out for, you know, several years, it may be difficult ultimately to get there.
It's kind of hard to feel like we're getting anywhere with inflation, like we're on a hamster wheel, sprinting in place. But Snaith says for now, that's okay.
The hamster's still working, I guess. And who is the hamster? Is it Powell? Is it the consumer? Is it all of us?
Maybe a tad existential. But the point is, we have to run in place for a bit to figure things out. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Who is the hamster? Wall Street today, stocks were down a little bit. Bonds, though, were the center of attention. Yields are going back up again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Remember cars and inflation, used cars in particular, and how early last year when chip shortages cratered the supply of new cars and buyers turned to the used market, those prices hit historic highs. Well, that was then. In the CPI this morning, the price of used cars and trucks was down 2.5% August to September, year on year down 8%. But if you're shopping for a used car now for the first time since before the pandemic, you are likely still in for some sticker shock, and it could last for a while, as Marketplace's Henry Epp reports.
Matt Van Wagner of South Burlington, Vermont, needs to replace his car.
We've got a 2006 Cadillac DTS. It's about 196,000 miles. It moans and groans more than I do in the morning.
He wants to find a used car to replace it, something only a few years old in the $15,000 to $20,000 range, but the options just aren't great.
I'm stuck in a mentality that used cars should be a lot cheaper than what they are.
They're not likely to get much cheaper. One reason, there's just not enough supply, because we're still seeing the effects of those chip shortages and COVID-era shutdowns that threw a wrench in the production of new vehicles, says Chris Fry with Cox Automotive.
I liken it to a boa constrictor that swallowed, let's say, a pig. And if you turn it upside down, that visual of the pig going through the snake, that's the hole in new production that we have to work through.
That hole has caused buyers of new cars to behave strangely, says Jessica Caldwell, an analyst at Edmunds.
They're either going to hold on to their vehicle, they're going to buy out their lease, they're going to do things they wouldn't typically do.
That's kept the supply of used cars tight. And it could get tighter if the UAW strikes create another hole in production. Meanwhile, demand isn't going away, even as interest rates for used car loans topped 11% in the third quarter, according to Edmunds. A lot of people have no choice but to drive. Kevin Hicks, general manager at Garso Auto Sales in Champlain, New York, sees that in his shop.
People are coming in that absolutely need a vehicle, not just because they want it, you know what I'm saying?
Still, Hicks says he's been able to keep his inventory pretty healthy, thanks to his dealership's location, just a couple miles from the Canadian border.
I have an alternate route I can buy out of Canada. There's plenty of supply in Canada as far as used vehicles.
Can any of our neighbors to the north let us in on your supply secret? I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
I don't know what kind of car David Brancaccio drives. I used to. Don't anymore. But I know what he listens to while he's in it. This program, and I listen to his while I'm driving mine. You should listen to his too. Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out. You got your regular gifts, your books, your clothing, art sometimes, music maybe, or travel, something else, don't know. But then you got your grandparent go-tos, the good old-fashioned U.S. savings bond. There is something like $68 billion worth of them out there. That's a point made by New York Times finance reporter Rob Copeland the other day, while pointing out that they are becoming increasingly difficult to cash in, those bonds are. Rob, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So for those unfamiliar, how do these savings bonds work?
So here's how they're supposed to work. You get a gift from someone, you buy a bond at half price for, say, $50. It comes in a paper slip, you cash it in 20 years, and it's worth twice as much as you paid.
And that's the interest that accrues, and then it comes to term, and you go and you cash it in. The catch, of course, is in the cashing it in, which you write about in this piece. Tell me about that.
Well, when these savings bonds came out at the height of the Great Depression, they were sold as good as cash. You would buy them and then you could cash them in at any bank or any financial institution. But what's happened over the past few years is a lot of banks are starting to reject them because these are U.S. government bonds, so they're not a loan from J.P. Morgan Chase. That's meant that for a lot of people, what they thought was cash was actually just a worthless piece of paper.
Yeah, let's go over that again. You walk into J.P. Morgan or Citibank or whatever, and you give them the $100 bond that your grandmother gave you 25 years ago. The bank has to wait for the Treasury to pay them back should they pay you out, right?
Exactly. They're essentially fronting you money. So they're giving you the government's money, but then they have to chase after the government. And let's say that you gave them a piece of paper that was a fake bond. Now right. They've given you cash and they've been fooled.
And is that what's going on here? Are they worried about, you know, frauds and fakery? Because, you know, 25 years ago, let's just say document security is not what it was, what it is today.
So that's what they say they're worried about.
Okay.
There's no doubt there is a level of fraud. There's also a level of fraud with personal checks. There's a level of fraud all over society. What's also happening here is that when a bank does that transaction for you, they make exactly 0 cents. Hmm. And in many cases, these banks just don't want to do it anymore.
Along those lines, actually, there not being a whole lot of interest accruing, you point out that give or take half the bonds that are out there sitting in people's drawers or whatever are well past maturity, and thus it's just us letting the government hang on to our money.
So this was wild to me. I received a gift, which were these savings bonds, some of which were from when I was born. And after 30 years, I'm 36, after 30 years, these bonds stop accruing interest. And so I reached out to the Treasury and I said, how many people are in a situation like me? How many of them have these bonds that will never be worth more than they're worth now? And almost half of them have that characteristic, $32 billion, which, as I write in the piece, is basically an interest-free loan from the citizenry to the government.
There are also, as you talk about in this piece, people who have not small amounts of money that they find in their, you know, passed away relative's attic or what have you, and they actually try to go direct to Treasury and get it done, and it's even convoluted that way.
Exactly. So the other option besides going to your bank is you can mail it in. Yes, actually put it in an envelope and mail it in, basically cross your heart and hope it gets there. The Treasury is supposed to cash it for you. At best, it will take them a few months. At worst, God only knows where it goes, or Treasury comes back to you after a few months and says that you didn't tick the right box, or you didn't give it the right stamp, or for instance, if you did it for an elderly parent or family member, you didn't include the right paperwork saying that you were allowed to do that for them. To the people I spoke to, it seems like the Treasury will go to any length to not pay them mm-hmm. for these bonds.
Mm-hmm. So what happened with you and the 30-year bonds that you got when you were born?
I'm so glad you asked. So I initially went to, I'm a Chase client, which is not an endorsement of Chase, obviously. And I went to the bank next to my apartment and they told me they would not cash any of them. And I went to the New York Times Credit Union. They would not cash any of them. I went to my online bank, same deal. So what I did is I wrote a story about it and I wrote about everyone else's experiences and really just briefly mentioned mine. After the story published, I went into the Chase Bank next to the New York Times office in Midtown Manhattan. I did not identify myself as a reporter. I had the exact same paper bonds that had earlier been rejected. They couldn't have been kinder. They said they had just received a notification from JPMorgan Chase updating them on their policy. She apologized to me, but it wasn't because she wouldn't cash them. She said, it's going to take me about 5 minutes to do the paperwork. So I stood there. The money was deposited into my account. I spoke truth to power, and it was quite the ending for me.
Public service journalism right there, ladies and gentlemen. Rob Copeland at the New York Times. Rob, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up.
It's very natural for us here in our local towns to help.
Takes a village, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 173 today. That's about a half percent, 33,631. The NASDAQ subtracted 85.6%, 13,574. The S&P 500 shrank 27 points, a little more than 0.6%, finished at 43.49. Ford Motor slipped 2% today after 8,700 United Auto Workers members in Kentucky expanded the union strike by walking out of the automaker's largest plant. Negotiations, you might have heard this, have broken down between Hollywood Studios and the Actors Union SAG-AFTRA, of which part represents the on-air staff here at Marketplace. Different part, though, not the striking part. That hurt shares in the big streaming companies. Walt Disney fell 0.6%. Comcast gave up 0.75%. Paramount Global declined almost 0.75% today. today. So here is some basic financial economics from the past couple of years. The yield on treasuries is up, as you're about to hear. So Bitcoin is down. That seems to be the way it works now. So too are shares in crypto companies. Coinbase descended 2.8%. Bitfarms gave up 2.9%. About the bonds, bond prices went down. That means yields go up. 10-year treasury, 4.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Big news. One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Delta Airlines reported third quarter earnings this morning. Profits were up 60% July, August, and September. Still lots of demand for travel, obviously, especially for what Delta calls its premium products, tickets that guarantee you seat selection and a little bit of extra legroom. Those sales, as well as business and first class, were up 17% year over year. That's compared to just 12% growth for seats in the back of the plane. CEO Ed Bastian said it looks like that trend is going to continue. And as Marketplace's Savannah Maher reports, Delta is not the only airline betting customers will shell out for an upgrade.
For a long time, most airlines' strategy was to jam as many people as possible into the main cabin and charge a premium for anything above coach, says David Slotnick with the travel site The Points Guy.
Those used to be priced exorbitantly. They were really for passengers who didn't care about price.
But the pandemic changed that. As restrictions started to ease, Slotnick says people were ready to travel again, but still COVID cautious. Plus, they had some extra savings, so they were willing to pay for more space from their fellow passengers.
And they realized, oh, this is actually kind of nice. I should do this more often.
He says airlines noticed this growing market for something between coach and business class. And after some tinkering, they seem to have figured out what travelers are willing to pay for premium economy seats.
And I mean, the airlines are doubling down on it, and it's just been a resounding success for them.
So what's in it for us when we shell out for the upgrade?
You're getting a quilted plush seat. You're getting free alcoholic beverages if you're over 21. Really nice amenity kits, memory foam pillows.
That's Sally French, who follows the travel industry for NerdWallet. She says the post-pandemic revenge traveler wants to feel a little spoiled while they fly. But another driver of premium economy sales is that the floor has moved, says travel analyst Lindsay Roschke with Morning Consult.
The basic economy has become incredibly bare bones.
Carry-on luggage only. You don't get to choose your seat.
You've got people who are the kind of more mainstream travelers who are looking at that and saying, actually, it makes more sense financially for me to trade up.
In some ways, Roschke says, today's premium economy is yesterday's standard. I'm Savannah Maher for Marketplace.
The United States is the biggest oil producer in the world. The Permian Basin out in West Texas accounts for 40% of all American oil production. And Pioneer Natural Resources is one of the biggest leaseholders in the Permian. So if you're Exxon, looking to double down almost literally on your capacity in the biggest oil producing region in the country, you say, sure, it's worth $60 billion to buy Pioneer. But among all the oil plays in all the towns in all the world, what exactly is it that makes that desolate stretch of West Texas such a prize? Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall has the story.
If the Permian Basin were its own country, it would be among the top five oil producers in the world, says Carr Ingham with the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers.
We just tend to look past this, how important this little part of Texas is down there. Production increases spectacular.
That's been true since fracking revived the Permian Basin around 2010. That created ample opportunity for companies like Pioneer.
Their cost of producing a barrel of oil out there is as low as anybody's. This is what is attractive to ExxonMobil.
And unlike more time-intensive projects like deep water drilling, Mark Finley at Rice University says,
it's something that you can exploit and develop relatively quickly and scale your activity up and down, depending on how the market circumstances play out.
He says uncertainty abroad is another reason Exxon and other U.S. multinationals are pushing to invest in the Permian.
Domestic barrels as a share of their global portfolio is much bigger now, and that's clearly what they're aiming for down the road.
And that's also good for national security, says Ed Herz with University of Houston.
We are very dependent upon our trading partners to get 6 to 7 million barrels of oil a day into the United States.
And as strategic petroleum reserves have been depleted,
it could put us in a difficult situation if a conflict in the Middle East spreads,
making production in the Permian Basin's quiet 66 West Texas and New Mexico counties all the more attractive. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Being a college student can be hard. Being a parent of a college student can be hard, too, but for different reasons. And therein lies a business opportunity. Saw this in the Wall Street Journal the other day. Services where, for give or take $50 a month, depending on the company, college students have access to what is basically a mom concierge service. Mindy Horowitz is the founder of one of them. It's called Mindy Knows. Mindy, welcome to the program.
I'm so happy to be here today.
I have to tell you, this is a completely novel concept to me. So I want you to tell me exactly what it is, what service it is that you offer.
So my oldest son is now 23, and he went to school in our hometown in St. Louis, Missouri. Mm-hmm. When he was in his first year, I immediately joined the parent page on Facebook for Watch Your Parents, and I would see all the things that the out-of-town families would need. And I realized quite quickly that as a local parent, I could help with some of the things that the families needed for their students.
Okay. So let's say it's mid-semester on a Tuesday. We're not in finals week yet. It might be midterms. Don't know. And you wake up and what does your day look like?
I don't know yet. Because
All right. No, give me a for instance.
On a Tuesday, I wake up, I listen to some NPR. No, just kidding.
Don't kid about that. That's very serious.
I'm sorry. I'm not kidding.
All right.
We love.
Okay. Thank you.
It really varies. I go pick up my cupcakes. I help give parents an idea about restaurants for family weekend or the best urgent care for a toe issue. The challenge is 99% of the time, they're just things that we all come across as parents in our communities. And that's what works so well in this business is that it's very natural for us here in our local towns to help. And it feels so foreign as a parent not knowing that town.
How do you set your prices? Because it's all a little bit, you know, bespoke, right?
Setting the pricing is the hardest thing.
Yeah.
I just always hated the idea of someone calling me and saying, hey, my student is sick. Can you bring them some chicken soup? And I never wanted to say, sure, for $125, I'm happy to do it. It doesn't feel right. But what I realize is that many people stay on. They join for the first month and then they realize that they like it and they continue. So that when things happen and they really need significant help, they already know me and they are comfortable to ask for whatever it is that I can help with.
Yeah. And also just on the people looking for your services thing, they are probably more comfortable with paying you and getting the expectation of a service instead of having it be like kind of a favor thing, because that's always just really awkward.
100%. That's exactly right. In fact, when my son was in his first year, we were at a family weekend with his roommate's mom, and his roommate was from New Jersey. And I realized that his roommate had hurt his knee and he had been hobbling around. And I said to the mom, I don't know why you didn't call me. I would have helped you. And she said, I didn't really know you and I didn't really want to bother right. you. And I realized that sometimes you just want to pay for help. You don't want to owe someone a favor. So,
you know, I get the helping parents out thing, right? Because, you know, parents have certain responsibilities to their kids and it's a, you know, a different city or what have you. There are going to be those listening to this interview, though, thinking about the college kids in question and saying to themselves, these kids have gone away to college. And part of the reason they've gone away to college is to learn how to be a grown-up and an adult, and they don't really need somebody bringing them cupcakes. What do you say to that?
Well, we do bring them cupcakes on their birthdays, but our students learn to become independent adults, and they solve most of their own problems. We just provide the support to parents by giving them the access that they need to our local resources. And we all know that as parents, there's no hard stop on parenting when our kids leave for college. And we just help reduce the stress that comes along with that.
Mindy Horowitz, founder of Mindy Knows in St. Louis, Mo. Mindy, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
I love talking to you. Thank you very much.
This final note on the way out today, which I'll preface by observing that back in July, the Congressional Budget Office said that interest payments on the federal debt, just interest, would come to $663 billion this year. I mention that because the Internal Revenue Service said today that the gross tax gap in 2021, that's the difference between taxes that should have been paid but weren't, was $688 billion. I just figured that'd be good information to have on hand, because once Republicans in the House finally figure out what they're doing, there's going to be lots and lots of talk of government spending and deficits as they try to keep the government funded. All right, we got to go here, though. Your moment of economic context, of course, possibly related to that tax gap item a minute ago. I'm kidding, but I did think this was interesting. An item in the Wall Street Journal today that said the number of accounting graduates, that's with either bachelor's or master's degrees, was down 7.5% from 2021 to 2022. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Petra, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Mir Babawi is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.